When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 148. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm not travelling too far at all, just over the English border, in fact, into Shropshire to talk to farmer Mark Clear. Mark, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Will. Very well.
Good. It is about a million degrees outside. We're recording in mid-August. How's your harvest going?
It is. It's another really hot, sweaty day here. But the novelty today is it has finally rained. So I'm feeling a little bit easier. Yeah. We've had a few really frustrating days waiting for unripe oats, which is the hardest thing of all, isn't it? Stopping is far harder than going. And we've got a lot of oats to cut, but I consider none of them quite ready. So we've been holding off. So I do feel slightly better now it's rained.
Good. Did you, you had the storms there though last night. Did it cause any damage?
We've got two ponies here, and they smashed down one of the walls of their stable in panic. We had some thunder that sounded I've never heard thunder before. The house shook last night about 11:30 midnight.
Yeah,
and so we were out very early hours this morning checking them, but no crop damage. Fortunately, our oat yields are so low this year, there's no danger of it going down.
There's farmers everywhere nodding, going, this is why you shouldn't have ponies on the farm, I guess. Tell us a bit about the area there where you're from.
We're from Shifnal, eastern Shropshire. So they're really the sort of the most arable part of Shropshire. Shropshire's obviously got everything in it. It's the greatest county, clearly, with land of all types. But it's a very productive part of the country, I think, really. Mm-hmm. We're the sort of eastern part of the West, if you like. We pretend it's a good place to grow arable crops. Good soil that I thank my grandfather for every day. They chose well when they moved here, and we've got flexible soil, so we've got options really when it comes to cropping. But nice farm and a nice place to live.
My wife would agree. Shropshire. She's from Shropshire, from Market Drayton, so not too far away from me. So it was your grandfather who moved to the farm originally.
It was. They came from they came a long way from Staffordshire. It was actually my great grandparents that moved to this area from Staffordshire, and then they had two sons, and they set them up on farms sort of either side of where I'm sitting now. Both of which we now farm, bizarrely. One we share farm, which is really nice.
That is nice.
So it was in the family 100 years ago, and we farm it now. But they bought the farm that I farm 100 years ago this year, 1920. Oh, wow. So we had planned a party. I'm not sure that's going to happen now, but 100 years ago this year.
That's really cool. I was just going to say, did you plan a party? It's always nice to mark those occasions, isn't it?
Yeah. I'd forgotten that we planned one, but that's such is life.
And growing up on the farm, did you always want to be a farmer?
I did, yeah. I fell in that trap, the classic trap of never wanting to do anything else. Spent all my time really on the farm as a child and hanging around it. And it was a time when we were quite a small farm. We're only 200 acres owned, so we're not a big farm. And that's all we were then. And it was difficult, really difficult times, I think, through the 1980s.
Yeah.
My enduring memory is my mother did everything to try and persuade me not to stay on the farm and be as miserable as my father was, really, I think, is the thing. So she tried very hard but failed miserably. Yeah. I only ever wanted to do this. And so, that meant really I started into a situation which really wasn't terribly viable at that time. Again, in fact, I don't suppose we were profitable at all then. It was a loss-making period, I would think.
Yeah, I would think quite a lot of people were encouraged not to go into farming in that time. And it did leave a mark on our generation, I think, didn't it, really? I grew up sort of, remember the 90s and BSE had a big effect on me and our family. It was really difficult for us.
Right.
And,
yeah. It's true. I think farmers were unpopular then. I think early 90s, which was when I was just kind of sort of coming back from college, it was the first cap, as we know it now, with set aside, which was, of course, so unpopular with everybody, unpopular with farmers and really unpopular with the public. Overproduction. It was a poor time for the image of farming and, you know, not something that I'm sure had I been the opposite generation, I'd have had real concerns for the next generation coming through at that time. Yeah, it was not a very happy industry.
Mm. And then you went a very long distance away to university, to Harper Adams.
Yes, not for very long. I made a mistake, really, not in going to Harper. Harper is great, and I'm still involved with Harper. But I didn't take the course I should have taken. I took the wrong one. I went to do agricultural engineering, which I didn't, as it turns out, wasn't not really what I should have done. It was, I know why I did it. It was because the feeling that the farm wasn't going to support me.
Yeah.
And there wasn't enough money for one generation. My grandparents were just about still with us. There wasn't enough money as it was without adding another generation in, another family in. Mm-hmm. And so it was a sort of idea to be more broadly qualified in something that I could do off farm or I could add value in other ways. So, I did agricultural engineering and I only managed 1 year of it and I left after the first year, which I'm always sorry about in a way. I would never recommend, my children know that I can't stand a quitter and I really prepared the thought that I did it, but I did move away. But that was actually a really good thing. I moved even closer, I think, or not much further away, to Walford, which was the Shropshire college at the time, and did a brilliant course there, a farm management course, National Certificate in Farm Management, which I absolutely loved, and that did change me. That really set me up, and I found that was an excellent course. So I've no regrets at having moved, but obviously regrets at having not got some swanky letters after my name.
So what were your farming ambitions at that time? Was it to sort of, as you said, to full-time farm on the family farm, but also perhaps supplement your income in other ways enough to support the farming?
Yeah, it was. I think you think you can do everything, don't you? Then the thing I did at Walford was this farm management thing really was a series of case studies, and we went around other farms. The idea is we all got in the minibus and we went to a farm and the farmer would talk us through the business pretty openly and honestly, and we would be tasked with writing a plan for that business to change the business into a diversification or something. So of course we knew nothing, we knew absolutely nothing, but you're put in the position of pretending to know better than the farmer that's presenting to you. So I'm always grateful to those farmers. They were great doing opening up to us, but it sort of, I think, it encouraged this idea that you can think imaginatively and, you know, you can transform a business by doing things differently, which of course you can't. You don't know anything. These people know exactly what they're doing and we didn't know any better than that. But I think that did influence me, and I came back with the idea that we should do everything. We ought to be doing this, that, the other. We ought to be rearing calves. The first thing I did actually it was my girlfriend at the time, my now wife, we set up a goat meat business straight off college. It was actually my college project at the end was this goat meat thing. And I mean, we threw ourselves into it and collected every unwanted billy goat kid in Shropshire and surrounded ourselves with masses of goat, far too many as it turned out. But we did manage to market some very well. It sort of put me off goats for the rest of my life, but it was typical of confidence, really, that you know, if you bought a goat kid for £1 you couldn't do anything other than make a profit. I'm not sure that proved to be the case, but
that's interesting because there's been quite a rise in goat meat consumption over the last
years, ahead of our time, obviously. It has. We thought that we did manage to persuade a few really nice restaurants to take to take carcasses from us, and there was a little abattoir at the time locally, so I was able to get it done myself, and it just wouldn't work now. But Yeah, we did manage to persuade a few people, and it was good fun. It was good fun, but whether it was ever a real viable business for us, I'm not so sure. But that was typical of the idea that we could, you know, I simply had to breeze in with new ideas, fresh ideas, and all would be well, which of course is not the case.
No. So despite only doing a year at Harper, you did go back there to do Basis not long after this, I guess.
Yeah. That was one of the hard, really hard thing to do. I think when you're at college, it's hard enough. When you leave college and then go back, it's really hard. Again, it was back to the idea that the farm really wasn't big enough. We tried to expand the farm. It was at the time again when there was a lot of change in the 90s. A lot of farm, the very big farmers now grew rapidly at that time. Mm-hmm. Didn't they? Contract farming agreements were new. Tenancies were being shaken up. There were some, you know, some of the big hitters around here were changing from 500 to 5,000 acres very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And I sort of thought, well, we could do that. But changing from 200 to 500 didn't give you the efficiency. you just couldn't keep track with these people. So it was clear that expanding with, particularly with overpaid rent, really, wasn't going to be a sensible thing to do. I was paying for agronomy at the time, and I'd had a sort of the bad example of agronomy, a sort of employed agronomist who was, I felt, was overselling to me.
Okay.
I was losing faith in the agronomy business, really. When I see Twitter now and I see people talking about things like this, I think that's exactly how I felt. Yeah. 20 years ago. I felt that we were applying more and more with more and more precision required, more and more urgency for no better control, certainly no better margins. And whether I felt that I could do better as a truly independent, doing my own agronomy, but there was a little bit of it where I thought maybe I can sell myself in a part-time way as a truly independent agronomist, which I never ever did. But it did encourage me to go and do Basis at Harper, which was really hard, actually, a really demanding thing to do. And just a bit depressing, really. I think the closer I got to the ag chem business, the more, in a way, I wanted to pull away from it, which is a bit ironic, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say about seeing people having those conversations now, isn't it? And you were having those at the time, because, you know, you do see that a lot more now, don't you? And I mean, the cost of inputs I think people just feeling that there's an imbalance, I guess, that we're going in the wrong direction. I think more and more people are waking up to that, aren't they?
Yes. I think you're right. And I think particularly, I mean, there's a problem, obviously, with cheaper chemistry is cheaper, so more inclined to maybe use it. And we were very much in that mold of, you know, chuck a splash of cypermethrin and it's only pennies. And it was really beginning to bother me that we appeared to be applying more, and I think we were. I don't think there's any doubt about it, we were. And you know, for me anyway, that feeling certainly was beginning to trouble me. In the late 1990s, really. We'd also got a young family then, young children, and getting a bit more sensitive, I think, as most people do when they've got young children around the farm, suddenly a bit more aware of risk and a bit more aware of danger. And, you know, I was doing the spraying myself, and I started to feel more personally concerned about the hygiene of sprays on myself and, you know, what I was handling. And, you know, I think a young family did also contribute to that feeling.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can relate to that as well. So how did having young children start to change your thoughts about farming practically? When did you sort of realise that, look, we need to change something here?
We were late 90s. We were looking more and more at organic, and there were other practical reasons as well. You know, things like you've got to have a proper spray store, and they were talking about spray remedies and all sorts of those problems for small farms, difficult things to overcome. But I think family certainly changed it. We have three children, two daughters and a son in between, and a daughter born in 95, son born 98, and our son born in 98, Edward, has Down syndrome, which was different. It was obviously unexpected and different, and that changed us in all sorts of ways. Having children changes you in all sorts of ways, obviously.
Yes.
But I think the combination, having children changes you. When something unexpected in life happens, it changes mm-hmm. you. And the two combined certainly influenced us. And having, you know, I think the feeling of wanting to be different and wanting to change, if you like, we were heading down a pretty conventional route.
Yeah.
As many people do, I think many people feel the pressure to continue, certainly in our industry. It's a huge problem that people inherit a sort of obligation to just keep doing the same thing. And I think I might well have done that had particularly Edward not been born, but it made us feel a little bit more like, I don't know, perhaps gave us a bit more confidence to be a bit different, be alternative. Yeah. And, you know, and not feel we had to conform to the expectations of neighbours and parents. My father thought organic conversion was a very bad idea. So
I was going to ask you about what your dad thought, because, you know, we all work with our dads on farms, don't we? And it can be difficult to change, as you said, you know.
Yeah, he thought it was ridiculous. He's still with us. My father's 91 now, but he was an older father. He was in his 40s when he had me, so he'd grown up through the period of chemical all ag chem and fertilizers, more or less, being introduced.
Yeah.
So he'd seen these magical things mm-hmm. appear. You know, he's so old that he remembers the time before, which is probably, you know, is a factor in this, that he can remember, you know, when they first got Roundup. Mm-hmm. How incredible would that have been? I think, you know, it must have been. You know, obviously now as a Roundup hater, I still can feel the excitement of how it must have felt to get your hands on something. A total weed killer must have been incredible. So, you know, the thought that I would willfully give up on all those things, I think he thought that must be crazy, absolutely crazy. So, no, he wasn't a fan of the idea, but I'm very fortunate to have had a father who was very willing to let me go my way, and he did do that, and I will always be grateful for that. He didn't stand in my way in that sense at all, but he didn't agree with it.
What does he think when he looks at the farm now and he sees
very
the system?
Happy Yeah, very happy. He's completely two-faced about the whole thing. He's done it ever since, really. He congratulated me on everything that's gone right, with completely overlooking the fact that he thought it was a very bad idea at the time. So,
classic dad move. Yeah. How did having Edward change you? You said it changed your outlook on farming, but, I mean, was it initially a shock? How did you deal with it at the time?
Yeah, huge shock. I think, you know, people go through this today. People go through this every day. And we all sort of bubble along, don't we, through life, and we sort of subconsciously expect everything to pan out as we expect it. You know, when you are expecting a baby, you are expecting a baby, a particular type of baby. Mm-hmm. And when things don't necessarily happen as you anticipate them, it is a shock, and you know, that's a challenge initially. But I think it did change us. It changed us from the people that we would have been, and not that we were awful people in any way, not that we're saints now, but it did introduce, I think, this idea that really positive things aren't always where you expect to find them. And, you know, and just playing it safe and staying on the same track isn't always the most rewarding thing. It feels like the safe thing to do, but when something is forced on you, you're forced to deal with it, and you deal with it as best you can. But I think that process did change both Liz and I, and we probably gained in confidence then. I wasn't a terribly confident person at all before that, and you know, I think a lot of the things that have happened subsequently would simply not have happened had it not been for that growing in confidence, and also the sort of being comfortable to be different, really.
Yeah.
And embracing difference more than just being that sort of very conservative, traditional, you know, character that plays it safe.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend farms in the States, Iowa, a guy called Chad Ingalls, who did a really good interview about this on the Shark Farmer podcast in the States. And he talked about, he's got two Down syndrome children. He talked about the challenges, but also the just the pure joy of having Down syndrome children and how that's sort of just affected his life in a similar way, I think. How it's sort of put minor problems and stresses into perspective, I guess.
Yes, I think, you know, to within reason, we all have a sort of an ability to worry. And, you know, you prioritise your worries, you prioritise your anxieties. And so, yeah, everything does come a bit more into perspective. But for us, I mean, it's a very, very positive thing indeed in our family and in our life. And it encouraged me to be more involved. I became a school governor because when Edward was five at primary school, you know, I was asked for my perspective as because of him. Mm-hmm. And so I became a school governor then, and I'm still a school governor now, and it's been a big part of my life.
Yeah.
He now works at the same school, bizarrely, but it became a part of my life that may not have happened, and I love that role, and I've had so much satisfaction from that role, and I think that's a perfect example of where a slightly different perspective can be applied back to the mainstream, if you like. And be a really positive one can help you to be constructive in the mainstream as well as in the special needs world, if you like.
Definitely. What would you like people to know about Edward? Because sometimes people are awkward around the subject of Down syndrome, aren't they? Don't know what to say. Sometimes they feel, and then they don't say anything, and then it kind of gets a bit awkward.
Yes. Well, actually, I think that what you just said there is one of the things that I like to think. I fail on this and I beat myself up for it, but I like to think I'm better at, and that's saying something.
Yeah.
As you say, in a lot of situations, and I think it's the same if you lose somebody close, if you've lost a parent or something and then somebody else does, you somehow feel qualified, more qualified, where previously you might have thought, you know, I'll avoid that person because I just don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And it's a good example. It's a very good example of that, where I think when you go through a situation like this, some people don't speak to you at all, of course. Mm-hmm. Other people are straight to the door. Incredible. And you don't realize at the time how incredible those people are.
Yeah.
But no, it does give you the confidence to say something, and hopefully the right thing, at least something. I think you appreciate people saying something, even if it's not the right thing.
Yeah.
But no, it does change that confidence. Edward is wonderful. It's fantastic. Yeah. You know, he's a central part of our family, as we all are. There's five of us in this family, and you know, we all support each other. Life is as it is, and it would be, you know, there is no ever any thought given to what it might be. How it might have been different, how it might be different. It is what it is, and it's wonderful. So no, we are very, very lucky to all be together in this.
Fantastic. And carrying on from your educational work as a school governor, you also have school visits to the farm. You've got a classroom there as well.
Yeah, I mean, that happened again, same thing really. It actually started right back then at starting. I offered to start a gardening club at school for children who were struggling to be engaged or motivated at school. So we just started a lunchtime club with a few youngsters who that quickly built into the idea that we should open the farm. We should do something. We could see how positively, again, looking at particular children, thinking of particular children respond so positively. But of course, particular children, all they are is a slightly exaggerated version of all children.
Yes.
All children respond really, nearly all children respond really positively to a farm environment, to growing stuff, to animals, clearly. And it became pretty obvious that we just had to do it, really. I think 2006, we started Educational Access. It was because it was spectacularly wet. And that first summer, we had duck boards around the yard just to get the kids around. But no, it felt like something we had to do to open the farm to primary school children in the main. And older children terrify me, so I've stuck my head.
You can't say that. You've got three older children.
Well, I know they are. But I do some secondary visits, and that is different, and that is a different challenge. But I very much enjoy the sort of 7 to 11 year old range, where children are just so receptive to stuff and to life, and they just soak it up, and but they don't already know necessarily. So you know you're in a very powerful position. You can tell them. You know, but, We've used the farm. I think we've used the farm quite effectively doing that. Mm. And it did get, like most things I do, it got a bit out of hand. We started doing too many. It was back in the days when countryside stewardship, the original countryside stewardship scheme, was a bit more flexible.
Okay.
With a local officer who was a bit more accommodating, and they allowed me double visits. So we were doing about 50 visits a year, and
that's a lot.
Half days to, you know, as somebody who donates a significant amount of their time to other things, you will understand this, that it was becoming a big problem.
Okay.
That I was giving a lot of time to something which had no financial sense, really.
Yeah. It's interesting because, again, you're probably a bit ahead of your time there now, because so many people are doing school visits now. I mean, I've spoke to several people on the podcast to do it, and of course there's also technology now with FaceTime a Farmer and things which I do, and it is one of the most rewarding things I do. I mean, I'm paired with a class in South London. None of the kids have ever been on a farm, sort of quite young children, maybe about 6 or 7. And it's just incredible to see the response on their face. You know, I went to one of my friends, we don't have sheep here, but I went to one of my friends' farm when they were lambing, and they saw a lamb being born, and just sort of for the boys especially, they always love the tractors and the machinery. You know, you get on a tractor and show them, sort of, you know, to them it's like being in a space rocket. And then they send me pictures, and the teacher, and it's just incredible thing to be part of, I think.
It is. We do just a few visits, again, I just can't fit them in. We do a few visits a year for FACE, and they do a thing with a chef on the farm, and they provide a chef who comes to the farm, and he comes crazy early in the morning, and he sets up all the gear to prepare a meal. And in order to get one of these visits, your school has to have a particular number of children in a particular degree of deprivation. So they don't tend to be local schools. They tend to be Birmingham schools that come. We split the day, so half the time they spend with chef cooking, and the other time they're with me. So we try and include something that we grow in the meals. So a bit of thought goes into that. But those visits are really special, special. When you get a tremendous ethnic diversity, tremendous diversity of language, you know, and children who, in many cases, rarely leave the estates they live on.
Yeah.
Just to be here is just fantastic. And it's a privilege, I think, to share that with children.
Yes.
So in some ways I find those the most rewarding visits. But as I say, we don't do as many as I used to do, and I did enjoy them, but yeah, they're very demanding. I'm effectively not here. When there's a school here, my phone is off, I might as well be not here. And I am the last person in the world to not be here. So it's a challenge, rewarding work.
Yeah. So when you first decided to convert to organic, how did you initially go about it? And what was the biggest challenge?
We were thinking, all when we go back to when we really were thinking about this, we were seriously about this, but I wasn't brave enough to do it. I think when you're on the point of that, and there are people who are on that point now, clearly, who think, yeah, but I can't do it because I can't live without glyphosate. I can't live without this. And I can't, all you think about is what you can't live without.
Yeah.
And you think, well, I can't imagine farming without that input. I can replace, you know, I can grow clover, so I can make nitrogen, I can do this, but I can't do that. And I was in that position of really stressing about the things we couldn't do without. And a farmer that we were renting some ground from at the time, a dairy farmer, he did convert.
Okay.
And he asked me if we would convert the land that we were renting from him.
I see.
And in doing so, produce organic fodder and grain for him. And that was it. That was the slight security that I needed. And we then converted that block, but we threw ourselves in and converted our own as well over the next couple of years. We were lucky that the Countryside Stewardship Scheme, CSS, the first full national scheme, was piloted in two places in our part of Shropshire, and I think over in Cambridge, I think, in a little small area over there. So there was a pilot CSS available. And that, for the first time, funded undersown grass lays, for example.
Yes, okay.
Things like that that hadn't been funded before. Arable Stewardship Scheme, it was called. That's what it was called. ASS, Arable Stewardship Scheme. And we joined that at the same time. And I found that that was really complementary because we could put the clover break in and get some income from it. And we built a rotation around options in that. And that gave us, that gave me some more financial security. So, I mean, the biggest initial challenge, I suppose, was stupidity on my part. And that was a feeling, we converted appropriately, we converted on the 1st of April, 2000. And I thought that if you convert in the spring, then you can sow all your crops in the autumn. Sorry, the conversion process takes 2 years.
Yeah.
To the day. So if you convert on the 1st of April 2000, your farm is organic on the 1st of April 2002.
Yeah.
And I thought, if, and I know a lot of people think this, if we picked a spring date, we could then sow our first crops, which would be organic, from the 2nd of April 2002.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
But if but also the other advantage with an April conversion date is that we, the crops we've got in the ground, we can put all those inputs on. We could stack all those inputs on in March.
Sure.
And we'll still get good yields. So yes. In March, the farm, a lot of the farm had winter wheat and all had winter cereals in it. So we put all the nitrogen on, all the P and K on, you know, a broad spectrum weed killer and a fungicide, whatever, all at the end of March, thinking that's, we're going to get great yields. Those were some of the worst yields that I've ever had in my life. Because the crops, they just died. They literally died. And by the end of June, they were brown. So it taught me from right from the start that organic is not a pick and mix option. Yeah. It's everything is connected, and if you know, if you show a crop nitrogen and don't show it fungicides, then basically you've got a problem. We all know this now, but I learned it that first year with some spectacularly poor yields.
And what were the neighbours saying then? Did you get many naysayers and people sort of saying, "What's he doing over there?"
One neighbour, I mean, like everybody, we've got the same sort of neighbours, and older gentleman was very critical, and has remained so. I don't know whether I've earned his respect yet, but has remained critical, and that I found that quite inspiring in a way. There's a certain sort of person, isn't there? And farming has them, everywhere has them, but farming certainly has them, who are rather old-fashioned in their attitudes to life. You know, the fact that I didn't fit in. Again, going back to what I was saying earlier, I think the fact that I didn't fit into his expectations was actually quite a boost.
That was
quite reassuring. It's never bothered me at all.
No. Does it drive you on, that sort of wanting to prove people wrong?
I think certainly that sort of attitude, it does. I mean, it's certainly still the case that there's still people with attitudes about inheritance and expectation and sons, daughters, all those sorts of stereotypes that farming has. I quite like the fact that I don't conform to those, and we've made it part of our life to be determined that we don't. And I think that goes back to 1998 as well, to be honest. I think that change in our family then may well have influenced that feeling of not being bothered too much. If we believe we're right, we keep faith in it, particularly if the people criticizing, I don't have, you know, if I don't respect them, then I don't worry too much.
So had you always been interested in nature and the environment around you? Were you sort of one of those kids growing up who was interested in that kind of stuff?
Yeah, very much so. It's a generational thing, and it's not a criticism, this, but the parts of the farm that I remember growing up, the parts of the farm that my father considered completely worthless are the bits of the farm that we value most in a way. And that is just a generational thing, I'm sure. That's not being organic. A lot of people have got that. I think we have changed so much. that you know, we don't, and I'm sure the vast majority of farmers would agree with this, that you know, we have habitats on this farm which have no commercial value at all, mm-hmm. and yet they are really special yeah. places. And you know, I'm proud to be able to manage them. And no, nature was always important. And again, that was very much another factor. Mm-hmm. We were right in that one of those last years before organic conversion. I was persuaded we had an outbreak of aphids on the ear. And I can't remember the name of the chemical. I did it. I was told to do it, and this stuff arrived. It was purple. I remember coming in litre bottles, and it was absolutely foul. I guess it had got some sort of smell introduced to it, so mm-hmm. nobody go near it. And so I did an ear spray insecticide, yeah. and I carried so much guilt about that. One year, I only ever did an ear spray insecticide mm-hmm. once, and I did it 1 year. I sitting and looking out on the field that I did it on now, I can remember how I felt. Really shamed really by that, and that came at a crucial time, and it was another factor that we'd done quite a lot of environmental damage then, just for the sake of a few aphids, which may or may not have had much impact, probably not with hindsight.
Yeah, what crops are you growing there on the farm now? I know you've got quite the range, really. So tell us about that and how the system works.
Yeah, we're diversity is, I'm in danger of slipping into a script here when I say that. It's the sort of thing that I do say. Diversity is everything in life, isn't it? We could talk yep. about that. It is, it certainly is in farming as well. And we are, you know, you can't pick and mix in organic. You have to throw yourself in, and it has to be diverse, I believe, or I don't think it works. And yep. So we have a reasonably diverse rotation. It could be more diverse. We've stuck with that original arable stewardship supported 5-year rotation back on day one. We still have a 5-year rotation with a 1-year grass lay in it.
Okay.
Which is unusual for most organic farmers have either 2 or 3 year clover lay for building up fertility and resolving weed issues. We have stuck with one really because livestock has never been a big thing on this farm. It's always been very secondary. Mm-hmm. So it was always about maximizing the arable output. I know a 2 or 3 year lay arguably might do that, but we committed to this 1 year lay in the belief that we could get the value from it in terms of fertility building, and then we could get 4 crops out of our rotation as well. And I think we're 20 years in now, and we've continued to do that. So it has worked. It has worked, but I know that things may be better, certainly on the weed front, if we had a longer lay. So we have single year clover lays. Some of it is grazing, some of it silage, but much of it is red clover seed, which is the hardest cropping thing we do.
Yeah.
So combine the red clover with a conventional combine in September.
Right, okay.
Which is a huge gamble. I'm not a gambler, and that is a gamble, because some years we get nothing at all. Other years it can be the most profitable crop on the farm, and we've been doing this for about 6 years, I think, and twice we've had no crop, twice it's been really profitable.
How's it looking this year?
It's looking good at the moment, but it often can at this time of year. I'm a bit worried that if it doesn't dry up again, that the clover, I mean, God knows, the crops this year, they don't know whether they're coming or going, do they? So the clover will probably be the same. But no, there is clover there. It's growing very strong and very lush at the moment, but it needs to start to change gear soon. And obviously, to put it through a combine, it's got to be brownish. It's got to be reasonably dead. And we're looking for that by the middle of September. So we do need it to stop raining and convince the stuff that it is August and not May.
It's been quite the year for growing, hasn't it? Tell us about your wheat varieties. You're growing 18 different types there.
Yes, we nearly stopped growing wheat about 3 years ago. Wheat is a really difficult crop organically, which seems like a funny thing to say, but the modern wheat is the problem.
Yeah, okay.
We have a lot of weeds on our farm, obviously. Not all organic farms are as dirty as ours. We're not great on weed control. And I think that a lot of that is the cropping system that I described. We have really struggled with modern, short, uncompetitive wheats, mm-hmm. which, of course, offer virtually no crop competition at all. They're so open.
Yeah.
And I reached the point about 4 or 5 years ago of being in such despair with unreliable wheat yields. And it was at a time when I was I was contacted by Martin Wolf, Professor Martin Wolf, from who was at ORC then, the Organic Research Centre, and he developed the Wakelands organic Wakelands population, which many people will be familiar with, is a true population that had been created by crossing 20 varieties with 20 other varieties to create 400 different lines. And that what that does, it gives you the diversity that then kickstarts a sort of evolution in the field, which you'll never get from a monocrop, or it'll take hundreds of years anyway, because outcrossing is so low in wheat that you need to start with diversity to begin with. Martin had done this, and I was completely smitten with Martin and the whole idea, and we agreed to grow the seed multiplication of the Wakelands population, and did that for a couple of years, and it was fantastic. It was a revelation to me. It grew about 4 foot tall. It competed with weeds. It produced a good crop, not a stellar crop, but a good crop. And it also took us into the world of millers and bakers, and it got us introduced to bakers who came onto the farm, and they were fascinated by how we grow the crops. And I love that. I love having people on the farm, particularly people who say nice things about you. And so it was that really that started the idea that we should be growing principally with the aim of selling to bakers.
Yes.
So we came from the brink of giving up on wheat. Wheat is now really, really important on this farm. And as you say, we've got 18 million crops this year, 16 of them already combined, thankfully. So we aim to sell, this is very much in development, but we aim to sell small quantities and large, but broken down into, you know, into small bags as well, to direct to home bakers, bakeries, millers, home millers, really anybody who is interested in named varieties that have an imagery, that have a story or a history and a distinctiveness that carries through into a bread product. And we're really enjoying that. It's a challenge, a huge challenge. Just at the moment, I mean, doing this now, my head is spinning with the 16 different wheats we've got at various stages through the dryer and cleaner and bagged or not bagged. It's taken on a whole new complexity. But
how do you store it all? How do you keep it all separate? Practicalities.
Everything will be bagged this year.
Okay, you're
everything's
right,
going to
okay.
be bagged. I mean, most of what we harvested last week is already bagged.
Okay.
Dried and bagged, not cleaned yet. They'll come back out. They're in ton bags. So they come back out into the cleaner and then back into smaller bags.
I see.
Bags are the key, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm trying to cut down on my plastic. But not doing very well on that. But it's the only way we can do it really and keep some degree of control over it. So it's logistically close to impossible, but it's an enterprise that we're really wanting to develop because we really enjoy that contact, direct contact with the end customer.
It's really exciting, that, isn't it? Because COVID has sort of brought bread and bread making back into the mainstream again, hasn't it? So, you know, you've seen so many people talking about it on social media or even in the sort of mainstream media articles where, you know, people baking sourdough bread or whatever it may be. And there's a lot of interest in that again, isn't there? Heritage varieties and things like that. Perhaps more than there's been for decades.
I mean, we sold more wheat during lockdown. I mean, it was useful in that sense, positive, if you can say that we were able to sell out our store from last year's wheat. But it's really exciting. It's a really... I don't know. I think one of the very few positives of the last few months has been that people have got a little bit closer to food. And the farming industry needs to respond positively to that and you know, do the right thing. And there's a good relationship being formed, I think.
Yeah. And you mentioned sort of connecting with people there. And in the sort of build up to this interview, I Google stalked you and found an article on agroecology. And there's a quote on that that really interests me. It said, connecting with the people who eat and process our food makes us feel like food producers rather than commodity producers. And it's much more rewarding. And again, I think a lot of people are just waking up to that, aren't they? I know I am, really, as much as anyone else.
Yeah, it is that. This started in a way about 6, 7, 8 years ago, and we were growing peas then. Peas are a nightmare, of course, and we still grow peas. They're a nightmare to grow, whatever your type of farming, but organically they're even worse. it's almost, you know, the weed, you can just imagine. I don't tweet pictures of my pea fields for a very good reason. They're a massive challenge. So when we'd grown these things 8 years ago, to be told that they're not worth very much this year, you know, mm-hmm. there's a boatload of imported peas come in and organic peas. And I went Googling and found a little company called Hobmadods then, who were really just embarking on their vision of retailing UK grown pulses direct to customers. Mm-hmm. And you know, they are great people who did a wonderful thing there. And that we got involved very quickly. We became the organic and organic pea grower for them then. And we continue to grow peas for them for human consumption. But getting involved with them transported me into a position of actually having that plus Twitter mm-hmm. enabled me to communicate directly with the customers who were buying a packet of peas in Lincoln. You know, and saying, "Oh, I've made such and such with these peas tonight. Really enjoyed them," and I was able then to communicate directly with that person in a really positive way, and that was new for me. And that introduced this real, I don't know, obsession perhaps, but desire to be closer to our customers and get that feedback, because that really is motivating. You need some motivation to grow organic peas, and that gives you the motivation. To keep doing it, so I thank them for that, and we've sort of taken that into our wheat grain milling grain thing, where, you know, it is so nice to get a phone call from somebody to say that what you've sent has been really appreciated.
And I think
getting back right to the start, you know, back in when we were young in the 80s and 90s, no farmer was ever thanked for anything.
No,
it was just all criticism, wasn't it?
It was, and I think it's quite interesting that the sort of you know, it's a well-documented mental health problem in agriculture. We talk about it a lot on the podcast. And I do wonder whether that has an impact on that, you know, just people being on their own, never hearing from the customers, never feeling like their work's appreciated. And as you say, just getting the chance to speak to people and people being interested, I think is got to help in that regard too, isn't it, I think?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it does. I think organic is better for that, and better in the sense that it is a much smaller world.
Yeah.
You know, when you are an organic farmer, when you become an organic farmer, Will, you'll find this. You step into a world away from the anonymity, really, of being non-organic, where I remember it very well. I didn't even know where it went. You know, the merchant would organise the wagon, you'd put it on the wagon and off it would go. The only thing you'd ever hear maybe was a claim if there was a problem. Nobody would ever ring up and say, "Thank you so much for that, you know, for that load of wheat you sent. It's beautiful." Organically, you still get claims. We still get nasty phone calls, but we know where it's going, and that connection does make you feel more appreciated. Yes, it's a healthy thing.
Yeah. Do you still grow Carlin peas there on the farm?
Yes, we cut them on Sunday. Yeah. Okay. These are the brown. The dark brown peas, which are the worst of the worst, really. they're only really grown as forage peas. If you buy a whole crop forage mix with peas in it, like a pea oat mix or pea barley mix, it might well have the dark brown peas in there.
Because
they're incredibly vigorous, but of course they go flat. They're hopeless for standing. So the darker the pea, the more hopeless they are. we've experimented with companion crops. I had a superb standing crop this year with a wonderful companion crop of fat hen and wild oats, which held up my peas off the ground superbly. We've tried it with sown triticale as well to try and keep the peas up and allow us to harvest them. But a big challenge, but a crop we're proud of when it goes.
Rest assured that even on conventional farms, they have problems with fat hen and wild oats too. This year has been the worst year we've ever had for wild oats. Yeah. Am I right in thinking that Carlin peas, did I read that they were traditionally eaten on bonfire night in Lancashire or something like that?
I'm sure you will have read that. They seem to be traditional in all regions of Britain, particularly where, how can I say this? I have to be careful how I say this. Sort of formerly maybe industrial or areas or, you know, the northeast of England, northwest of England, and the Black Country, certainly in the West Midlands. where they were a staple food, and you know, there are people who, not that long ago, so there's quite a bit of living memory out there for a paper cone full of Carling peas with vinegar on.
That's really interesting.
And and that has been, that's contributed to the success of these.
Yeah.
You know, they are like Granny used to make, or
yeah.
And I think they've come a bit like mushy peas. They've come back from the brink, really.
Yeah, well, I think things like that are important, aren't they, to the story behind a product? You know,
yeah.
people are interested in that, aren't they? I mean, I was just reading it. So
yeah. It's certainly, there's certainly a lot of connection to that history, and they all but disappeared. But no, we've benefited from a lot of interest. They're good.
Mm. So how much have the soils improved over the last 20 years? How much has the organic matter improved?
A lot. I kick myself daily that I didn't do baseline organic matter tests. We didn't do organic matter tests back then.
Yeah.
I don't know whether other people did, and it was just me. We used to do testing for MP and K, of course, and pH.
Yeah.
But I dug out all my old soil analysis from back then, and never did we pay the additional for an organic matter test.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably says it all, how we just didn't even think about it. We didn't see it as being significant. It was all about chemistry, wasn't it? It's all about the chemistry.
Very much so.
But we my big stumbling block pre-organic conversion was the fear of where we were going to find our P and K from.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that was a non-organic farmer thinking, we need P and K. We've got to have P and K in a bag. We put it on every year.
Yeah.
Farm will collapse without it. And I stumbled into the world of green waste composting then as an idea, as a concept that was just getting off the ground. And we were lucky in timing that we were able to set up a green waste composting operation, very small to begin with.
Okay.
At the same time as organic conversion. So I started out with the aim of making our own P and K rich fertilizer. And we still do it. So composting has been in tandem with organic farming all the way through. So nearly all our land has had quite a lot of green waste compost over the years. And most of our organic matters are 5% now. So I guess they started at about 2.
Wow,
We were in an awful, you know, a very poor system of continuous winter cereals, really.
Mm.
No grass in the rotation, no rotation, really. So my expectation is that we've put at least 3% organic matter. And you can feel that. You can see it and you can feel it. It's pretty obvious.
And again, you were ahead of your time there, because, I mean, a lot more people talking about composting now. I don't know if you were at Groundswell last year and saw that huge composter that was there. I saw it. I was really impressed with it. And, you know, you look at people who are doing it and the results are obvious, aren't they?
Yeah.
As you've just mentioned.
No, you're right. There are. I was there, and I'm afraid I have a phobia of an allergy to spending money on composting, because I feel composting is one of those things, and I know I'll get criticised by the scientists for saying this, but composting really it was happening long before we were here. You know, nature knows how to make compost, and we don't need necessarily to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds in order to do it, but we've always tried to keep it very simple. That's a challenge because the Environment Agency legislates it. So it's a challenge to keep anything simple when they're in charge.
Yes.
It's been simple. It remains simple on our farm. And it's been good for us. Yeah.
Mm.
It's been positive for us. So I have to be grateful for that stroke of luck, really. Just getting in at the start, and we were ahead of a little bit ahead of the game there, which was good.
Do you sell it as well?
No. Everything we ever make, we keep. So we make about 3,500 tons a year of finished compost, and it all goes on our ground. So it's had a lot, and we tend to apply about 40 tons to the hectare twice in a rotation, so two years and five, maybe three on some land. So quite a significant amount. And this last crazy 12 months of weather, actually, I think we've really seen that benefit. I think it's helped us. I really do think it's helped us. So
Are you all zero till there? Are you looking to improve the soils even more?
We absolutely are. We have cultivation guilt, as well. You know, we're all together in this. That I think this is one of the exciting things about this time we are now in, that this whole them and us thing about organic and non-organic is hopefully breaking down for good.
I think it is.
It's been a really unhealthy thing over the last few years. But the soil movement, if you like, is we're finding such common ground there.
Which is
good, apart from the fact that no-till and organic, of course, are not happy bedfellows at all. Mm-hmm. And that is a big challenge for us. But we're certainly trying. I'm delighted to be a part of an innovative farmer's field lab this year on living mulches. Mm-hmm. And there are six of us involved. And what we've done is we've, in the main, I think more or less everyone's succeeded in doing it. We've undersown micro clover, tiny white clover, which only grows about 3 to 4 inches high.
Okay.
In the bottom of standing crops, so undersown, with the intention, our intention is to graze sheep hard on that and then direct drill winter cereals.
Is that in the wheat?
I've got it in two fields this year, three crops actually. I've done some underwinter wheats, which hasn't worked very well because they were heritage wheats, and I didn't think it would, but it hasn't worked very well because they're 4 foot tall. Mm-hmm. It worked really well under spring wheat, as you'd expect. We always undersow our lays, but always under spring oats, and that normally works well. Wheat's even better because it's more open.
Yeah.
But we've also undersown a block of buckwheat as well, which appears to work very well. I think other years with a more normal weather, that may not be quite so successful, but it's worked this year. Mm. So we've got our blocks of undersown clover ready now, or they're coming in our stubbles, and we will hopefully direct drill in October. And that's the test. Next year is the test. Anyone can undersow it. It's whether we can direct drill it and control the weeds. But if we can, and we can reduce, we're not going zero till. We're not going in any way every year. But if we can reduce, we're currently playing 4 years in five. If we can drop that to 2 or 3 years in five, then that's very important. I think soil, once a couple of very wise people have said to me over the years that, you know, just do more right than wrong. If you can do more things right than wrong, nobody's doing everything right. Mm. Nobody. And you know, we can beat each other up over ploughshares versus glyphosate or whatever. But at the end of the day, nobody's doing everything right.
Yeah.
The important thing is that we just try and do as much right as we can.
Definitely. I think that's really important, actually, because sometimes you can, if you think you've got to get everything right, you won't do it at all, will you? I think that's a really good way of putting it.
For the organic farmers particularly, it's such a holy grail, really, this idea that we can achieve this. I'm really excited about it, but also really pessimistic about it, because I think what we're going to learn predominantly is what doesn't work. But that's useful. The six of us in it, if we can learn something that does work between us, that will be really positive.
What does the future hold for you, Mark? Where would you like this business to be in 10 years' time? Huge amount of potential there, and you're obviously excited about the future.
Well, goodness me, will this even be a business in 10 years' time? I'm feeling quite old just at the moment. It's been a hard spring, and it's been a spring that I think a lot of people are questioning themselves, questioning their own life and particularly their own working life. And we certainly have, and we're talking about it a lot, and I know other people are as well, that do we want to go back the same? Do we want to just carry on? And lockdown left us short-staffed and overworked, and we've had all farms have continued throughout the period, of course, and a lot have actually been under more pressure than they are normally, mm-hmm. and they're normally under a lot of pressure, and we've been in that category. So we're going to change things. We are determined to change things. We are beginning to put together a plan to be really quite different within 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. So that the next 10 years of our farming is a bit easier. It's ruled us. The downside of having all this lovely diversity and loads of enterprises on the farm and having a dabble with everything, it's a nightmare. You know, when you... I think if you have a relatively simple business, the idea of a diverse one is really exciting and challenging and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. When you have a really complicated one, you yearn for a really simple one.
it's very human to do that, isn't it?
No, it strikes me on Twitter just a bit recently that some of the most enthusiastic people wanting stock back on farms are people that don't have any stock.
I've noticed that as well.
So, you know, our cows got out last night as well. It's no fun. It's no fun at all. So I think we're looking at a simpler future, and answer your question. And a farm that we can enjoy again more rather than one that rules our lives, really. So simpler, smaller. We're going to end up getting smaller, and that deliberately so, I think.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
Fantastic. All right. Let's wrap this up with the five traditional hard-hitting questions, if you're ready. What is your all-time favourite song? Difficult question, I know.
Oh, really difficult question. There are so many, but I think this might strike a chord with you, because I think you tweeted about this a few weeks ago. We've been lucky enough to go and see Paul Simon twice.
Wow.
And the opening to Graceland.
Yeah.
Which I think you tweeted a couple of weeks ago as being one of the greatest opening lines.
Yeah.
Was just spine tingling. So, yeah, Liz and I were there, and we together decided that that is the musical moment, really, if not song. But the first line of Graceland live was something else.
Brilliant. The Mississippi Delta is shining like a national guitar. Brilliant. Love that.
Yeah.
If you weren't a farmer, if you hadn't gone down this route, what do you think you'd have done instead?
Well, I've been lucky because I've managed to combine some of the things that I love, and I always felt that I would have liked to have been a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I've managed to do that through having educational access on the farm.
Yeah.
So it's either that or a builder. I love oak framing, and we've cool. built a few buildings on the farm as well with oak.
Sure.
So yeah, maybe a teacher that builds in the holidays. Like
what's the best book you've ever read?
I don't read very much. I'm afraid I suffer with terrible time management, and I only tend to read on holiday. But the book that I remember reading on holiday that moved me most was Kite Runner, the Khaled Hosseini book.
Yeah.
And there was a second one which was equally good, I think. But Kite Runner, the first time before the film or before anything else, was really struck me. Yeah.
Yeah, I read that. It was superbly moving novel, wasn't it? You could go back in time and give your 18-year-old self a piece of advice, what would it be?
I think, thinking back to when I was 18, I was driving a VW Beetle, which I loved. And I decided, in stupidity, I'd sold it and bought a Suzuki Jeep, which we also loved.
Yeah.
But I practically gave away that Beetle. And I wish I'd kept it.
Yeah.
I wish I'd kept it. It would have been the best investment I'd ever made. I forget what I got for it. A couple of £100 I got for it. And we so should have kept that Beetle somewhere.
What colour was it?
Two-tone blue.
Oh, brilliant.
It was dark blue, and we painted the sides in a paler blue, so yeah, it was even nicer than that. You know, it was something else. So yeah, nice. Shouldn't have ever let that go. Practically gave it away.
Yeah. All right then. Lastly then, what is your favorite agriculture related social media account to follow?
Well, I'm sure he's not boring, but this answer is a bit boring because I know it's not the first time you've heard this. I think JR from Strictly is the king of Twitter in terms of agricultural issues. I don't know how he does it. Almost every tweet is a really, really good one. I know he lives in an iconic landscape and it is stunning, but no, I think that for consistently high quality, I think it has to be James.
Yeah, I'd agree. And if he's listening, he is such a nice guy as well. Great family, I think. So yeah, he's so good at what he does. But Mark, it's been great to talk to you and learn more about what you're doing there. Thank you for your time. I know it's a busy time of year for you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening. I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.